And we are welcoming now Uriah Kriegel, who is Directeur de Recherche here at, in Paris at the Institut Jean Nicot, which is part of the CNRS. And he is well known for his work, first for his work in philosophy of mind, and he's published a number of books at Oxford University Press, starting with Subjective Consciousness, The Sources of Intentionality, and The Varieties of Consciousness, and Mind and Reality in Brentano's Philosophical System. So, and I don't know for how many years, but he has started being also active in metaphysics for a number of years, and starting, I think, with Brentano's metaphysics, but more generally, many topics in contemporary metaphysics. So we are very pleased to have Uriah in this conference, and he's going to talk today about vertical mereology.
Merci Jean-Baptiste, merci de m'avoir invité. Je vais parler en anglais par paresse, mais je peux prendre des questions en français plus tard. So the topic, by the way, I'm active in metaphysics since I was 12, but, okay. but not producing anything of interest to other human beings. So vertical metaphysics, vertical mereology, what is that? It's nothing, I made it up. But the thought that I had is that most discussions of mereology today, certainly, are discussions of part-whole relations between concrete particulars. So when does a plurality of concrete particulars compose a further concrete particular? And there's also in the tradition of logical atomism, there are questions about the composition and decomposition of states of affairs, for example. When do atomic states of affairs conjointly compose molecular states of affairs? And so these kinds of questions about the composition of entities of ontological category C by other entities also from ontological category C, I will just call it horizontal mereology. And vertical mereology will be the mereology concerned with the composition of ontological of entities of ontological category C by entities of ontological category C star. So transcategorial composition. That's the kind of thing I'm interested in. And more specifically, I'm interested in the prospects for composition of concrete particulars by entities which are not concrete particulars. What are the options here? One option is composing concrete particulars from properties. So this will be like the bundle theory of concrete particulars that says that this table, for example, is just the bundle of its properties, except that the bundling operation will just be understood as composition. So it's basically a kind of a mereological bundle theory. So that's one option, an option that Laurie Paul has explored. There are really three or four sub-options here. One is to the idea of composing this table from, let's say, seeing this table as the mereological sum of universals ante rem. So brownness as such, solidity as such, etc. The mereological sum of these will give you the table. That's one option. Another option is to take universal in re. So a universal in re is different from a universal ante rem in that it exists within space-time, but it has the following peculiarity, that it can be wholly present in different places at the same time. So this table is present only here right now. The state of Hawaii is present in different places at the same time, on Oahu, on Maui, on Kauai, etc. But it's only partially present on each of the islands. Brownness, the idea goes, is fully present here, but also fully present here and fully present there. And so that's an in re universal. So could we see the table as a mirological sum of in re universals? A third option, could it be the mirological sum of tropes? This particular brownness, this particular solidity, this particular rectangularity, and so on and so forth. And the fourth option, of course, is some combination of those. Suppose there will be seven options. Anti-rem and in-re universals, anti-rem and universals, and so on and so forth. So that's one group of possibilities. I suppose there's also the possibility of thinking of the table as nothing but the mirological sum of events, certain events. Another option is to see the table as a mirological sum of facts or states of affairs construed as simple unstructured entities. So the typical conception of a state of affairs is just, it's an object having a property or a plurality of objects bearing a relation. But some people, like Brian Skirms, for example, and I think on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, David Armstrong held that the states of affairs are these kinds of unstructured, simple entities. And so maybe you could think, maybe this table is just it's a mirological sum of all the tabley facts. And then there's also the mix and match option. Maybe it's the tropes plus the facts. So together they compose the table. Let's call mirological bundle theory actually any theory of this shape that tries to identify the table with a mirological sum of entities which are not concrete particulars. What I think is that it's not going to work. So this is what this talk is about. The talk is about it's not working. And I suppose as a corollary, you'd have to say that if none of this is going to work, then we have to treat concrete particulars. So this is a positive thesis. We'd have to treat concrete particulars as vertical mirological simples. So entities that are not vertically composed. And if you make certain assumptions about the relationship between composition and fundamentality, then you'll have a further consequence, which is that concrete particulars must be part of the fundamental furniture of the world. But I'm not going to argue for any of these additional principles. I really what I want to do is argue against mirological bundle theory. Now, my argument starts off basically from this kind of informal complaint you often hear about bundle theories in general, that there's something too insubstantial about a collection of properties to make up a table. Like this table, it's so meaty, it's so thingy, and just a collection of properties, for example, is not. I'm going to focus on properties, but I think my argument will generalize. So a collection of properties is not thingy enough to amount to a table or any other concrete particular. Now, I think in this form, surely the complaint is a little question begging, since the theory just is the theory, that a corporeal substance is nothing but the sum of the its properties, let's say. And so to say, to consider it an objection to say, but no, because a sum of properties is not corporeal. It's just kind of a foot stomping. It's not. It doesn't produce any new dielectrical pressure. But I think there's a way to unpack the sentiment that bothers the objector to the bundle theory that will result in an argument that's not question begging. And in order to do that, we need to kind of look in particular at why it is that the table is a concrete entity. What does it mean to say that? Because notice that if we say it's a bundle of the table is just a bundle of universals, then we say it's a bundle, or it's a mereological sum in this case. It's a mereological sum of abstract universals. If we say that it's a mereological sum of tropes, we say it's a mereological sum of abstract particulars. So maybe abstract particulars, maybe abstract universals, but in any case, abstract as opposed to concrete. And so what does it take really for a collection of abstract entities to collectively make up, let's say, or amount to a concrete entity? I think to understand how that might be possible, we need to go a bit into the distinction between abstract and concrete. And so I think the most natural view here is that an abstract entity is non-spatiotemporal, whereas a concrete entity is spatiotemporal. It's just that this characterization is compatible with many different ideas. So one thing you might have in mind is that concrete entities have spatiotemporal properties, whereas abstract entities don't have spatiotemporal entities. But that can't be right, because some abstract entities seem to have, some entities we would intuitively consider abstract have spatiotemporal properties. For example, when I say that chess was invented in India in the 6th century, I don't mean that this or that particular chess set was fabricated in India in the 6th century. The game as such, as an abstract entity, was invented in India in the 6th century. That's a spatial property, the India part, 6th century, it's a temporal property. And so it seems to me like chess here, with this criterion, would come out a concrete entity, which would be very strange. Also think about, let's say, the number 17 was the most popular number in New Zealand in 1972. It's also, again, it's a kind of a spatiotemporal property of an abstract entity. And so we need something more specific. Another option might be to say a concrete entity has spatiotemporal location. It's not just spatiotemporal properties, it has a spatiotemporal location, whereas an abstract entity doesn't have spatiotemporal location. This, I think, trope theory will reject. They will just not agree to engage in the following debate, because they think that the brownness trope of this table is located here. It's not located in my office on Rue d'Ulm. It's located here. And yet, it's an abstract particular, not a concrete particular. And so trope theorists will not accept to setting the rules of the game by saying concrete means has spatial temporal location, abstract means doesn't have spatial temporal location. So I think what trope theorists want to say is that concrete particulars like this table, they cannot share space So this table and this cup, they sort of exclude each other from space. You can't sort of squeeze them into the very same location. This is the old idea of the impenetrability of corporeal substances. Whereas they compete for space. There's only one concrete particular at a place at a time. Whereas tropes, there can be many of them in the same place at the same time. So this table's brownness, this table's solidity, this table's rectangularity, they're all here. They're all in the same place. They don't exclude each other. They're not impenetrable. That would be, I think, what the trope theorists will say is the distinction between abstract and concrete. I think this is better, but it runs against the problem that it prejudges a certain debate and B, prejudges it, if anything, in the wrong way. And I have in mind a debate about the statue and the clay, the idea that the question of whether the statue and the lump of clay that constitutes it are one thing or two things. So I think that two-thingism here is much more plausible because, you know, they have different modal properties, for one thing. The statue cannot survive crushing, but the lump of clay can survive crushing. And so they have different modal properties, and so they can't be the same thing. And so I'm a two-thingist. And according to this view, according to the view that draws the distinction between abstract and particular in terms of impenetrability, it would mean that the statue and the clay both are abstract. And so I think it decides the debate in the wrong way, but I don't actually think that's the worst problem. The worst problem is to just decide the debate by fiat, so that we don't need actually to debate it. So once you're clear on the word, what the words mean, you see that there's really only one option. And so what are we to do? How should we draw the concrete abstract distinction? I think if we reflect a bit on why we want to say that despite their interpenetrability, both the statue and the lump of clay are concrete, the most reasonable thing to say, the thing that recommends itself, is to say that each of them occupies a portion of space. So occupying a portion of space-time is more than just having spatial temporal properties. It's more than having locations. Part of the reason why all these tropes, the brownness trope, the rectangularity trope, the solidity trope, they all kind of cluster, they don't bother each other. It's like they don't actually occupy any space. I want to argue for this more at length later, but just to give you a sense of the argument I have in mind. I think we treat tropes as abstract because we think they don't occupy the space in which they are located. And so this is what I think we should do. We should draw the abstract concrete distinction in terms of not occupying space or occupying space, or space-time, really. Now, if that's what you say, then when you think about it, if you have a bunch of entities that do not occupy space, and now you take the mereological sum of them, it'd be very weird for the mereological sum of them to occupy space. How can the mereological sum of objects of no volume have a non-zero volume? It's just very strange. So this is what I think underlies the thought that a mereological sum of properties is not substantial enough to amount to a concrete particular. So the argument is something like that, like this. Premise one, material objects occupy space. Premise two, properties do not occupy space. Premise three, no mereological sum of entities that do not occupy space occupies space. Conclusion, no mereological sum of properties is a material object. I'm going to say it again. Premise one, material objects occupy space. Premise two, properties do not occupy space. Premise three, a mereological sum of entities that do not occupy space does not occupy space. Conclusion, a mereological sum of properties is not a material object. And now what I want to do is defend each of the premises. When should I finish speaking?
Well, either at 6 or 5 past 6.
Cool. Premise one was material objects occupy space. It's very hard to see how to object to this. Maybe people will say, when you look at the subatomic level, you have all these concrete particulars, but they don't really, the standard model in particle physics does not really assign any size to them. The calculations that particle physicists do assume that the particles are point particles, so they don't have volume. They don't occupy, they don't fill up space. One thing I want to say up front on this is an area in which fools rush in, especially fools who like me, who don't really, whose particle physics is largely Wikipedia derived. And so I should warn you, what I'm going to say in the next 5 minutes, do not teach this to your children. So there are really two things I want to say here. One is, from what I understand, in particle physics, you have two kinds of elementary particles. You have the bosons, some of which, looking at Alexandre, tentatively, some of which are probably massless. And if they have no mass, maybe you can say, but maybe they have no volume. They literally don't have any size. But on the other hand, you have the fermions. And the fermions, from what I understand, all have some non-zero mass. Very strange to don't really understand how they can have non-zero mass without occupying space. And I suspect, so one issue is, it's true that the standard model does not assign any size to these particles, to any fermions, but I think mostly it's because our knowledge in this area is very sketchy. From what I understand, there's actually some kind of exciting area of speculating about the size of an electron, which is a type of fermion. And so the physicists, from what I understand, do assume that it does have some kind of size. It's just that we really don't know what kind of size it is. And in any case, we don't need to appeal to size in order to taxonomize the elementary particles. Correct me if I'm wrong about this, but I think the bosons and the fermions are distinguished in terms of their spin. They have systematically different spins. And within the fermions, you have the leptons, mainly the electron, and then the quarks, and they are distinguished mainly in terms of charge. And so with charge and spin, you taxonomize all the elementary particles, and you don't need to appeal to to size. Nonetheless, my understanding is that physicists don't think that that they literally don't have any size. Just that, so they're not positively committed to sizeless particles. So that's one thing I want to say. But in a way, the thing that's most important to me is to say, if particle physics told us that this table is made of a collection of entities, none of which occupies space, I think we would have to say that then particle physics does not help us render intelligible the structure of reality. Not that it like shows us, wow, look, what a cool thing you have space occupying holes, none of whose parts occupy space. And this is something more general that we spoke about over lunch, Alexandre, that it's one thing if there was like a recognized science of the fundamental level of reality. There was a consensus interpretation. So take that science with the whole collection of equations and constants and say if there was a consensus interpretation of how the world is, and that interpretation made very clear what the structure, made intelligible to us the structure of the material world, then I would happily say, well, then if it shows that there are these material objects that occupy no space, or maybe no material object occupies any space, then I would have to take it on at face value. But we really don't have any of this. Certainly not a consensus interpretation that everyone agrees sort of what the world must be like. This is my defense of the first premise that material objects occupy space. My formulation of the argument, the premises were all in the form of generics rather than quantified premises. I actually think that the first premise, I only need the existential quantification that some material objects occupy space, because then I can add no property occupies space, and then I get a valid argument there. So that's in defense of the first premise. The second premise, the premise that properties do not occupy space. Here we need to sort of look at each of the type of entities properties might be. I think with anti-Rem universals, we don't actually need to worry about them. They clearly don't occupy space. So wisdom as such in the Platonic realm does not occupy space. Now, in Ray universals, remember, these are the entities that are wholly present in different places at the same time. I think it's very hard to imagine an entity that has this mode of being, and for it to be present in a place is for it to occupy some space in that place. Think of what it would mean. It would mean that the whole of brownness occupies the region of space filled by this table. The whole of brownness. Brownness in its entirety is confined to this table. You tend to say, well, if the whole of brown is here, then none of brownness is out of here. None of brownness is there on that nice kind of Japanese style wall entity. But the proponent of the space occupying in Ray universals would tell us, yeah. Even though the whole of brownness is confined to this space, some of it is actually there too. Actually, the whole of it is there too. Which interestingly means that since there are 2 meters distance, 4 meters distance, this brownness lies at 4 meters distance from itself. Now, to be clear, I'm not saying that I'm actually understanding any of these sentences that I'm saying. What I'm saying is, these are some of the sentences you would have to understand in order to make sense of space occupying in ray universals. And so I think this is really a non-starter. The best option here is to say maybe tropes are space-occupying entities. And Keith Campbell, when you read him, I think that's actually what he has in mind. So Keith Campbell says, there are no shape tropes and volume tropes. What there are shaped volume tropes. So what you have is a brown, a table-shaped brown, brown volume. That's the brownness trope of this table is just a table-shaped brown volume. And the solidity or this table solidity is a table-shaped solid volume. This is how he could, and he says shape, volume, and quality, like color or solidity, that's just a distinction that we make in thought. It's not a distinction in reality. So these are interazionis. I think there are many problems with these kinds of entities, with conceiving of tropes like this. So, for example, think of the solidity-shaped, the table-shaped solid volume here. Is it brown or is it not brown? If you say it's not brown, how come when I look at the volume, I see brown? This is the volume that you tell me the solidity, and it is brown. So you're telling me it's colorless? It's very hard to understand. But if you say it is brown, actually, the solidity trope is brown, then I ask, so why is this a solidity trope rather than a brownness trope? So I think these Campbell-style tropes are problematic entities. But more importantly to me, and this is what I really want to press, is that if we accept Campbell-style tropes in our ontology, I think we have to say that, in fact, they are concrete particulars. They are not abstract particulars, because they occupy space. And granted, they are slightly curious concrete particulars, because they are single propertied concrete particulars. And that creates some of the problems that I just mentioned, and others that I don't have time to go into, but I think essentially there would be concrete particulars. And so if you had a mereological bundle theory with Campbell tropes as the constituents whose mereological sum gives you the table, then you would have an assay of the table in terms of entities that are not tables, but you would not have an assay of a concrete particular in terms of entities that are not concrete particulars, because the Campbell tropes are concrete particulars. All right, so that's for the second premise. I have 5 minutes tops, I see. For the third premise, this...
You may took 7 minutes.
Thank you. Cool. There's like a bunch more arguments. So the third premise is the premise that a mereological sum of entities that do not occupy space does not occupy space. I actually don't see how you can reject that. In fact, the notion that is so weird, Leibniz scholars have this problem that Leibniz says somewhere that the bodies are just aggregates of monads, and our monads are are volumeless, immaterial objects. They don't occupy space. And so there is this problem. How can bodies be nothing but aggregates of monads? And from what I understand, basically what every single Leibniz scholar says is, well, he must not mean that literally. He must mean rather that they are the ground. They are so the monads ground in some way the bodies, but the bodies. Even that sounds weird because we think of grounding as allowing nothing over and above kind of claim. There's still. There's still some kind of ontological daylight that Leibniz must assume between the aggregate of monads and the bodies. That's what basically every, I'm looking at Jean Pascal, who nods, luckily, every Leibniz scholar says. And so it actually, this could inspire a kind of retreat from the mereological bundle theory that says the table is identical to the sum of its properties, to something like the table is grounded in the sum of its properties. Maybe that kind of sounds good. Maybe you can imagine how a sum of entities that do not occupy space can ground an entity that occupies space. But I actually think that the only reason this sounds a little bit better, to put this the thesis in terms of grounding rather than in terms of identity, is because there is a kind of unclarity baked into grounding about what kind of ontological daylight is allowed between the grounded and the ground. So here's an implausible thesis. Justice is grounded in this cup, fully grounded, not partially grounded, fully grounded. The full ground of justice is this cup. I think we can rule that out a priori just by understanding what grounding is. And so just the notion of grounding puts some constraints on what entities, how different entities can be consistent with one grounding the other. It's just that justice and this cup are so different that it can't be that this cup will ground justice. So I think the reason it sounds a bit more acceptable that maybe the table is grounded in the sum of its properties, or more generally, that space-occupying entities are grounded in sums of non-space-occupying entities, is just because we are really unclear on what's allowed and what's not allowed. But still, nonetheless, I want to say that there are two important features of grounding that suggest that there can't really be grounding of space-occupying entities by mereological sum of non-space-occupying entities. One aspect of grounding is that grounding should be explanatory. Certainly in the standard way, the Kit Fine way of understanding grounding, it's an explanatory relation. The ground explains, not causally, but metaphysically explains the grounded. There are huge issues about what that means, but I think you'd need a very strange notion of metaphysical explanation in which you could see why there should be here a space-occupying entity, given that there's a mereological sum of non-space-occupying entities. So mereological sum, so you don't get an explanation of the presence of a space-occupying entity from the fact that we have a mereological sum of entities that don't occupy space. So that's one thing. And the other thing with grounding is that because the grounded is supposed to be nothing over and above the ground, it's supposed to be an ontological free lunch, That's how Fine, Schaffer, etc., think of this. That really, if you want to see to sum up the entire cost of your ontology, you just have to sum up the ontological cost of all of your ungrounded entities, all your fundamentals. All the grounded stuff comes for free. This is a natural way of thinking of this. And so it means that if you had a mirological bundle theory, then the total ontological cost of your ontology, of your ontological theory, will just be the sum of the costs of all the non-space occupying entities, and then when you say, and by the way, I also think that in the world there are some entities that occupy space, but that's just a free lunch. It's just a very strange thing to say that to think of this as an ontological free lunch. That now that we've had only entities that do not occupy space, now we're adding an entity that occupies space, but it doesn't make any difference to the ontological cost, the total ontological cost of the theory. So given these two kind of aspects of grounding, I think it's actually not plausible. It's marginally more plausible, let's say, that an entity that occupies space is grounded in a mirological sum of entities that do not occupy space than to say that it is the sum of the non-space occupying entities. So that's my defense of the third premise. And so to remind you, the first premise was that material objects occupy space. The second one was that properties do not occupy space. And the third one was that a mirological sum of entities that do not occupy space does not occupy space. And the conclusion was a mirological sum of properties is not a material object. And you can run it also with grounding. And I think you can run it also with events instead of properties, with events and facts. And the reason I say this is that I'm just going to leave this as a cryptic remark. I think of events and facts as also abstract particulars, though not necessarily like tropes, but they are other kinds of abstract particulars. And so given that they too are abstract, they're not going to occupy space, and then you're going to be able to run the same argument. Obviously, I haven't argued for that at all. Thank you.
Thank you very much.